So as I mentioned, the last couple of weeks we have taken a look at a morally corrupt king, Xerxes, and his morally corrupt kingdom, I guess you'd say. Xerxes was, you know, a man who thought he was God. Thought he was God, and at the same time, thinking that he was God, he was also, I guess, tormented, whether he realized it or not, by his sinful humanity. And so he followed his desires, his desire for power, his desire for women, his desire for wealth, his desire for notoriety. In essence, he was pursuing his own glory, and he was pursuing it in such a way that was damaging both to himself and to his wives and to his officials and nobles and to all the people in his kingdom, really. So we looked at this king. We looked at this king who, as a sinful man, thought he was God, and what kind of damage and what kind of atmosphere he created, which led into the second week when we kind of evaluated what it was like in his kingdom. And last week we talked about how men were emasculated and how men lived their lives not really worthy of respect, but desperately wanting respect anyway. And so that led into a royal edict from King Xerxes when Vashti, the queen herself, refused him, the king, and her husband. And so that respect for men in the kingdom had to be enforced by a royal edict, a word, in essence, from God with a lowercase g, which is how Xerxes saw himself. And as we looked at king, and as we looked at kingdom, and just the dysfunctionalness of all of that, I'm hoping that, that what we all took out of those discussions was a longing for something better. A longing for something better. And I don't have to keep it a secret in here. I mean, the something better obviously is Jesus the King and the kingdom that Jesus ushers in. But in essence, it leaves us longing for better. And so today we kind of shift the spotlight from Xerxes in the first couple of verses of this, and we have a new character entering the scene or the stage. But first, let's look at that. See, what most commentators think that about 4 years have passed since Vashti was kind of banished from Xerxes' sight. And now, as we enter into to chapter 2, Xerxes is feeling kind of in a funk, okay? He's remembering what things were like, the way things used to be. He's remembering how beautiful Vashti was. Timeline-wise, I read that in one of the commentaries that during that four-year period was when Xerxes' attempt to conquer Greece failed as well. So this is a guy who's, kind of down in the dumps. He's kind of down in the dumps. And so his advisors, these young men who surround him, they see that. And they kind of probably talk amongst themselves, and they think, we've got to do something here. We've got to do something here to get Xerxes out of his funk. And so they come up with this idea. They decide that they are going to produce a reality TV show, and they're going to call it The Bachelor. Isn't that what this story is like? Isn't that what that reminds you of? We have the Bachelor, kind of, he's powerful and he's got, he's good looking, but he's kind of quiet and a little bit sullen. And so we take this kind of mysterious Bachelor and, he's a king. And then we're going to get girls from all over the kingdom and they're going to compete for his favor. I mean, isn't that exactly what The Bachelor is? It's interesting. You know, I do not remember where I either heard this or read this, but it was sometime in the last 10 years because that show has been on for a long time. But anyway, it was a comment that The Bachelor, that whole concept, that whole TV show, begins as a man's greatest fantasy and ends as a woman's greatest fantasy. So it begins with, you know, one guy just surrounded by women who are competing for his attention, which is like, you know, this is heaven. Who wouldn't want this? And it ends with one girl being chosen from among all of the girls in the entire world to be the wife of this man. But anyway, it was just interesting. It was a little bit sarcastic and cynical. But anyway, this is what is going on in this story. That is the stage that's being set here. And so, as we kind of think about this scene and the logistics of it and kind of, you know, I don't want to get into too many details. I mean, you can go kind of far. In essence, Xerxes is lining up just, you know, hundreds of women for to be prepared to spend, you know, like one night with him, and then they leave, and then, you know, out of those 400, he's going to choose one to make queen. It's really kind of sick. And you know, true to form for his kingship, true to form in his kingdom, yes, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that goes on. But because this happens, because all of this happens, and Xerxes takes this advice from his advisors on how to handle things, now we get to meet this new character. We get to meet Esther. And now what does it say about Esther? She was beautiful. It says that numerous times. Esther was beautiful. She had something going for her. But she also had, you know, kind of a history with her too. She was an orphan being raised by her uncle Mordecai. And also, she was a Jew. She was of Hebrew origin. And, you know, the biggest question I had when I got into chapter 2 here was, you know, what was the big deal? Why did Mordecai tell her to keep her nationality a secret? And I had some trouble finding, you know, why that was. But I came across something extremely interesting, and I hadn't put it together up until I read it. But do you understand that at this point in history, it was actually Xerxes' grandfather that allowed all of the exiles to go back to Jerusalem? It was Xerxes' grandfather, Cyrus, who, once he took power as the Persian Empire, they conquered Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. And during the first year of Cyrus's reign, he said, the Jews can go back to their homeland and start to rebuild. We read about that in Ezra and Nehemiah. And so that led, obviously, to another question. Why are Mordecai and Esther still here in Persia? And the article that I read about that was that we are to see, at least Mordecai, who was, you know, the head of that family. Esther was probably a young girl. But at least Mordecai, you know, he's kind of a lukewarm believer. He's a lukewarm Jew. And after 70 years in captivity for his family, he had become, you know, very well-adjusted and well-accustomed to Persian life. Away from Jerusalem, away from God's law and all the ceremonial regulations, away from the dietary laws, just away from where his ancestry was. And so, you know, that kind of paints Mordecai immediately not as you know, kind of a co-hero of the story, because most of you know where the story goes, but, you know, Mordecai was a pretty regular Jew, a pretty, you know, culturally compromised believer. I mean, life was pretty good in Persia, so why answer that call of God to go back to Jerusalem? And so this is going to be an interesting thing to think about as we look at Esther a little bit today and as we look at her farther on too. Because see, there's three views that we can take of Esther, okay? And, this is going to be kind of the main content of what we deal with for the next few minutes tonight. And then I think that we'll be situated well to move forward in the story and to actually be able to look at it with eyes that are seeing truth. But there's three views that you can take of Esther. And the first one is probably the one that we're most prone to go to right away. And that is this picture of Esther as a godly woman from beginning to end. Okay, so we picture Esther as, this Jewish girl, and she's doing the best that she can to serve God and serve others. She's keeping the law. She's going to synagogue. But you know what? We don't see any of that in here. It doesn't even mention Esther praying in here. And so that image of Esther, leading Bible studies once she gets accepted into the harem, that's probably not an accurate picture. As a matter of fact, Esther was probably, associated herself with her Jewish heritage, but she probably wasn't really living it much at all. And so if you'd ask her, Esther, are you one of God's chosen people? She would have said yes. But then if you said, well, what makes you different? She would probably have been kind of taken aback and said, well, really nothing. I'm doing, just kind of going along to get along. And so that view of Esther as, this godly woman from start to finish, I don't think that's going to be helpful to us as we carry on the rest of the story. The second view of Esther is, it probably does have some truth to it. It probably has some truth to it, but the second view of Esther would be to view her as a girl who had absolutely no choices. Okay, this was a girl who was at the mercy not only of King Xerxes and his, his attendants and his, talent seekers around the kingdom, but she was also a victim of Mordecai and submitting to Mordecai's will in all of these situations. And who knows? Maybe it was Mordecai's idea that she enter this contest as it was. And like I said, there's probably some truth to that. There's probably truth to the just when you think about Esther's situation. She maybe was a girl that didn't have many choices of getting ahead in life. But that's really all I'm going to grant her. Because if she had refused, if she had stood up and refused and said, no, that's a dirty king, and he's into bad things, and I'm a chosen person of God, and I don't want to be a part of that. What would have been done to her? I mean, Vashti was the queen herself, and she publicly shamed the king, and it's not like she was killed. She was just sent away to a different part of the harem. And so knowing that, I would argue that Esther did have choices. And yes, maybe we can pity her. Maybe her lot in life wasn't the best and she didn't have many options to get ahead. But when it came to engaging in this corrupt behavior and being a part of this scheme of the king and his advisors, she, I would say, had the power to say no if she hadn't wanted to be a part of it. And so what's the third option? The third option is the one I'm going to go with. That's always, the last one's always the one that I'm going to push for, okay? The third option is this. As we think about what happened in chapter 2 today and as we move forward, what if we just view Esther as someone, you know, kind of like us? And I don't mean to be condemnatory, but all of us kind of suffer from this kind of compromising attitude toward the culture that we live in. We have a very difficult time, even in the church, even as Christians, being countercultural, which is what we are ultimately called to be in this life. But we all struggle with it, don't we? And we all struggle with it to different degrees and to different measures. But what if we were just to honestly look at Esther as a sinner like us? Let's not give her sainthood right off the bat in this story because we kind of know the trajectory of it. At least coming in, let's just say that Esther is like us. Esther is just like me, only she's got the looks, okay? She's been given this opportunity. And we're going to see what she's able to do with it. But she's lukewarm. She doesn't have strong ties to her, you know, faith that has been, you know, lasted for generations before. She doesn't have strong ties to the God of Isaac and Jacob and Abraham. She doesn't have strong commitments in terms of her religious obligations. She is probably considering herself a believer in one of God's people, but she's not really living it out, at least at first. And so as we move forward, we look at Esther that way. But in closing here, we also have to look at Esther another way too. And this is more looking into the future. This is more looking in terms of what God is able to do through her. Okay? Because Esther, even though we're going to look at her as kind of a lukewarm believer, you know, a sinner just like us, you know, she's going to move from that point A to a point B. Okay? We know that. And so the way she is being framed here, the way she's being framed up, even in these early chapters, is she is being framed up as a savior. Do you see that? She is destined to intercede for her people, people still living in exile, but she is going to be a mediator. She is going to be a savior for her people. Just like Joseph in the Old Testament was a savior of his people. I mean, actually, a lot of the commentators go back to that story to compare with Esther. I mean, in the same way that Esther finds herself in this situation in a foreign land, away from God, so Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt, and he was taken away from the family, away from the faith, and, you know, he found himself in a situation. God worked behind the scenes in that story, too, to raise him to this position of power in a time and in a way that he could intercede, and during that time of famine, he could save his family because he was in a position to do so. But Esther is being set up as a savior herself, just like Joseph, just like Moses, just like Joshua, just like David. And so we need to keep that in the back of our minds too. Even in all of her flaws and her faults and her sin, she is going to be used by God in amazing ways. But as we look forward to that, and as we have eyes to see how God is going to raise her to a position to save her people, just as we looked at Xerxes and longed for a better king, just as we looked at Xerxes' kingdom and longed for a better kingdom, so now we will look at Esther and what God does through her, raising her up to be a savior to her people. And we are going to long for a better savior as well. Because what Esther ends up doing here is brave, and it's courageous, and it is inspired by God, and it's orchestrated by God, but the salvation she brings is only temporary. It is only locked into a time period. And so as great of a story as that is, we need to look to something greater for it to really impact our lives. And that's something greater in every Savior story in the Old Testament. That something greater is Jesus, who came and paid the ultimate penalty for us so that we could be saved, not just today and tomorrow in our lifetime, but forever.